it needs to become a norm for democratic countries to understand that they have to pay a premium to secure their supply chains and their economy. It's no longer the case to just simply go for the cheapest option.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Athena Tong. Athena is originally from Hong Kong. She served as Director of Public Relations for the now disbanded pro-democracy Demosesto Party in Hong Kong. Now based in Japan, as a visiting researcher at the University of Tokyo, Athena focuses on infrastructure resilience, political warfare, and economic security, with an emphasis on communist China's influence in East Asia and the Indo-Pacific. Her writing has been published by the Jamestown Foundation, Nikkei Asia, and the China Strategic Risks Institute. Athena, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cody.
Tell me about growing up in Hong Kong.
Well, I was born and raised in Hong Kong. I've always been with my family in Hong Kong Island. For me, Hong Kong has always been multicultural, very diverse. There was almost a sentiment that it is given that we had the freedom to criticize and to ask questions and to participate, even though initially I feel like in the 90s and the 2000s, because of how well Hong Kong economy was doing, that it's a little similar to how participation in politics is today in Japan, in that people are doing fine, so they don't necessarily feel an absolute obligation to vote or to participate or to protest, so to say. However, that has obviously changed since then. We have had 2012, 2014, 2016, 2019 different political episodes where it rendered the public to have the sense that we have to say something and rather loudly. Obviously, that really altered how Hong Kongers live in Hong Kong these days with the subsequent legislation. So talking about growing up in Hong Kong, we have had our givens when we were in the 90s to 2000s, where life was good, taxes still remain low, relative rule of law and democracy, and that has impacted how we grew up. That meant that we grew up with an understanding of our colonial history, with, for example, the founding of the PRC, how Hong Kong came to be after 1997. But that has altered a lot, changed multiple times, even throughout my 20-ish years living in Hong Kong. But it did teach us quite a lot about resilience, and it taught us a lot about understanding other cultures and being more able to adapt really to any environment, even in diaspora these days.
Interesting. Yeah, if you've ever spent any time in a Hong Kong wet market, you'll hear people asking questions. They'll be haggling about things. They'll be asking each other things. And for me, I was back in Hong Kong in May earlier this year, and you get to know someone and immediately there's 20 questions, including what is your salary, where did you go to school, etc. And so there is this history of asking questions, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you do get a degree of this in China, but certainly there is a history of inquisition and mm-hmm. asking questions, and it's quite markedly different with China, isn't it?
I mean, it's even different with a lot of other places in Asia, because people would not be personally offended if you ask the hard questions. And it's not
are
just
you married, and how much money are you making?
That, but also when even in the work environment,
yeah.
When a colleague maybe is not performing up to standard, in Hong Kong, it's perfectly okay to just talk to them directly about it. Whereas in other places in Asia, that might be a little more difficult. But I find that this directness and this ability to be more inquisitive and questioning things that are not going right, it did render the city a lot more efficient in any aspect, really, not just the work bits, but the infrastructure and how we communicate. Even by the speed we can walk in the street, that in itself is quite different.
Well, and if you ever go to a Hong Kong-style cafe or breakfast place, the speed at which they take your order and expect you to leave is unmatched. Tell me, though, how did you get interested in politics?
Actually, started in media. So I was a fixer and an interpreter when we were filming a documentary for this Franco-German TV channel called Arte. And it was a filming and post-production process that lasted around 6 months. And during that, I met a lot of different political figures in Hong Kong, be them traditional pro-democracy figures, younger ones that are more localist or pro-self-determination. We also met people who are pro-establishment, just to get the spectrum, really, to show the spectrum and how that has evolved. So at the end of the post-production period, I was asked to join one of the Legislative Council offices, and that's how I started in politics. In a work capacity. But from a personal capacity, I started in 2014 with the Umbrella Movement. I was a second year university student back then, just one of the many participants that were in the street of Admiralty at the time when we were fighting for the universal suffrage that was promised to Hong Kong at the signing of the Sino-British Joint Declaration, which of course China later on said is just a historical document.
So what motivated you at that time? You know, you're in university. What pushed you to join in with the Umbrella Movement in 2014?
Well, first of all, the leaders of the Umbrella Movement, they are around my age. Everybody is plus or minus 2 years my age. So I see people who are my age leading this, first of all. Second of all, because I was studying European studies at the time. And our professors, they are, of course, very passionate about such freedoms, notwithstanding, of course, the freedom of expression, freedom of political participation, but, of course, also how to hold the government accountable. They talked to us about the 1968 student movement in France, and they talked to us a lot about the importance of these freedoms and whether there's a limit to it, when it is justifiably limited or regulated, and when it is not. So we actually went as a class, well, not just a class, really. We also had people from different years of the program joining us. And in that environment, given that it's a very university student-centric kind of movement, especially in the beginning, we also have classmates from other majors, but also other universities who would go together. And it became a movement, and that is not just about political elites or people who are elected. It's really you as a university student, you're empowered to speak your truth and to fight for your city, so to say, and to get what you were promised.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting period of youth that, I mean, many of us are familiar. We go through, we're in university, we start asking questions, we get involved with certain things, and sometimes we look back and we're a bit... maybe embarrassed at, you know, how outspoken we were without knowing things. But at the same time, it's important to actually go through that process of feeling like you have a voice, that you are able to rally together and give it a go. And it seems like this was quite important for you. And certainly the later 2019, 2020 protests in Hong Kong, one of the key sites of that engagement with the authorities was a university, right? There was, I think, the Hong Kong Technical University.
I mean, there were a few, but the major ones were at the Chinese University of Hong Kong and the Polytechnic University.
There's a really good documentary, Behind the Red Brick Wall.
Yeah, I saw that. That was the film I saw. That was the last film I saw before leaving Hong Kong.
Okay.
It was also the last screening available in Hong Kong.
Why did you leave Hong Kong?
I left Hong Kong because of political risks. So I left at the end of 2022. At the time, it was obvious that some sort of crackdown is happening, in addition to the many political arrests that had already been made. That it would be foolish to stay with the thought that I would somehow be immune to being arrested, given my involvement with not only Democisto, but also in the movement itself. Nobody knew quite sure where the line was because of how vaguely worded the national security law in 2020 was. And there had been consistently a lot of my friends and former colleagues who had been brought in either for questioning or for arrest. Even if they didn't end up going to jail, they would be on bail with their passports taken away, meaning that they cannot leave Hong Kong even for a holiday. So that's not something that I see myself in the role of. Of course, there are political figures who have been arrested And because they are in jail, that we are able to continue advocating for not only them, but also for the cause, because they are unjustifiably incarcerated. But at the same time, I'm not somebody who's super public, who had been super public at the time in 2019, 2020, because it was more an anonymous situation, a more decentralized movement of protest. And there were so many people arrested that I didn't want to just become a statistic. So from my position, for me, it felt better to be going abroad and working for the cause from abroad rather than being in Hong Kong with the constraints that were there.
Yeah, perhaps more effective to be out of the country, right? And I found a statistic when I was looking into this, according to Amnesty International, more than 80% of people prosecuted under the national security law likely should never have been charged. Mm-hmm. The wording around that, any kind of seditious statements, very broad strokes around subversion, secession, mm-hmm. Colluding with foreign forces, and as you say, it can kind of be used to prosecute anyone for anything.
Exactly.
And so maybe you end up self-censoring, or you put yourself at great risk, right?
Yes. Of course, I have great respect for my friends who decide to stay. There are those who, and I agree with them, that Hong Kong land should be governed by Hong Kong people. And therefore, we can't all leave, obviously. But in regards to the risks, yes, because you have the national security law in 2020, but you also, as you mentioned, have the Safeguarding National Security Ordinance in 2024. And that is an added layer without the possibility of early release on good behavior.
Okay, so is this Article 23 then?
Yes, so Article 23 is the article in the basic law that mandates that such a law has to be a local legislation.
Okay. Interesting. So there's sort of, maybe they doubled down on it with that.
Higher punitive measures and no early release, as mentioned.
Interesting. Yep. So we've got this situation where you left Hong Kong. You're now based in Tokyo.
Yes.
What's your situation here in Japan? What are you doing?
So right now I'm a researcher here at the University of Tokyo, but I also work with think tanks like China Strategic Risk Institute and Pacific Forum. I work mainly on China influence and how they are taking up a lot of the supply chain. Supply chain, yes, but also how countries in East Asia have been reliant on China in terms of critical infrastructure or other important products that could affect national security. Things like submarine cables, things like satellites, telecoms, those are things that I'm working on right now. But of course, I also touch on information warfare, political warfare, like psychological and cognitive sides of that.
Yeah, I'm really interested to dive into the infrastructure piece a little bit later on. Mm. You mentioned submarine cables, and everyone would be familiar with the arguments around some of the 5G infrastructure that's coming out of China.
Yeah.
But starting off, I am keen to dive into this idea of narrative shaping and psychological operations.
Mm-hmm.
You've just written a piece for Nikkei Asia, The Fire That Hong Kong Wants You to Forget. You talking about the tragic fire that broke out just recently in Wang Fuk Court Apartments in Tai Po District. I think over 150 people died, sadly, in that tragedy. Yet you write about how authorities have been pushing this narrative around these bamboo scaffoldings, which have been used for hundreds of years in construction. I mean, they're an iconic part of Hong Kong visual culture. You see Jackie Chan hanging off these in films and stuff. They've been around for a long time. But you're sort of saying how the narrative has been pushed that it's about these bamboo scaffolds, whereas perhaps instead the blaze actually comes from somewhere else, perhaps around corruption and neglect. And so I wondered if you could sort of walk me through your thesis on this bamboo situation and what it all means.
Well, it started with the bamboo argument, because not only did the Hong Kong government rush to say, oh, maybe we should be banning bamboo and switching to metal rods instead, but several international outlets also interviewed, so to say, experts who are in Hong Kong who didn't necessarily grow up there, And they also did rush to conclusions, which has been falsified in the past couple of days, and with PK Tang actually reversing on what he initially said about bamboos. But the point is that, of course we have to find why, in terms of physics, the fire started, but at the root of it, it's not the material, because whatever material you're using, if it's not compliant and nobody's checking on it, it will still be causing some sort of disaster. So while, yes, physically we want to know what happened, but if you don't resolve the more systemic issues of negligence, of possible collusion and bid rigging, we don't know yet. We're still waiting on the investigation, if there is to be a thorough investigation, to know if this is what happened, this is what caused it, why is there no check and balances. That is at the heart of it, and that's the longer battle in this.
I understand. You mentioned PK Tang. Who was that?
PK Tang, he was born from a police background, and he is responsible for the security side of things, basically what John Lee was before he became the chief executive of Hong Kong. But yeah. John Lee, before he became chief executive, he was the head of security in Hong Kong.
Oh, and so that's PK Tang's role now, I understand. Okay, so he's sort of changed his position, maybe initially was talking about the bamboo outright, and now he's saying, okay, there's more nuance. But this is interesting, because I want to dive into this, because there has been some backpedaling in I guess the news media about this. Yet when I searched for bamboo flammability on Google, obviously the first result that comes up is the Global Times, which is a Chinese communist propaganda mouthpiece. And in fact, the Google summary took it from that Global Times article, and it said how untreated raw bamboo has a certain combustibility, and it said under Chinese mainland standards it can be easily ignited when near flammable materials such as foam panels.
Yes, exactly.
Which is very interesting, but I mean, we're getting into the minutiae of this bamboo story, but the kind of I think I understand what you're suggesting is that it would be easy to point to the materials and say, okay, it was a tragedy, and it was a tragedy, but actually there's something deeper and perhaps more pernicious about the whole situation around the material, the contractors, who was doing it, what was the oversight. And as you write, what used to be a contested public sphere, lawmakers demanding documents, journalists running data projects, civil groups litigating and lobbying, it's now replaced by a narrower ecosystem in which official messaging travels with less resistance, helping consolidate a memory of typo as an unfortunate accident of culture and physics rather than a predictable outcome of collusion and negligence.
That's correct. I mean, I worked in that sphere of where lawmakers could ask the hard questions, bring out the data that were discovered by journalists. And we have very, very good journalists in Hong Kong. Even today, you will see the journalist from Associated Press. He was questioning John Lee.
I saw that.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw it referenced in The Guardian, and he was asking him pretty harsh questions.
Yeah, he basically said that you promised Hong Kong people that you would bring, you would govern Hong Kong in a way that would bring Hong Kong out of chaos and into prosperity. But this prosperous version of Hong Kong has allowed 151 people to burn to death, essentially. Or,
and are you going to resign, I think he asked.
Why should you still be able to keep your job, is what he asked.
Why should you still be able to keep your job, he asked.
Yeah, but of course not every occasion will allow for such a question, and there may be constraints around how much access the journalists will have going forward.
So taking this particular situation, which is fresh in everyone's minds, it's quite relevant right now, and it's still unfolding. How do we begin to look at this, Athena? Because the situation referenced in that article you just referenced was these kinds of questions would never be asked of Xi Jinping, and the questions would never reach his ears. And so we've got maybe a fundamentally different approach to the role of civil society in engaging the political world. Yet, I mean, increasingly we do see, even out of the United States, if we're honest, a rerouting of information, of narratives, and it can be actually quite overwhelming. And I mean, you're researching this field, but globally, and I'm certainly keen to focus on China, but globally it seems there's a real challenge around getting to truth
Mm-hmm.
And what is actually happening? And I wonder, I mean, just starting from the top, how would you even frame this field of research, this field of understanding?
Some people would call it basically researching the work of the United Front. But for me, it's more than that.
United Front? What do you mean?
United Front is basically the mechanism, the official mechanisms being used by the PRC government in Beijing to propagate the messages in any sphere, basically, notwithstanding, for example, social media or academia abroad. So United Front mainly manipulates the information space of foreign countries, really.
So this United Front, is this something that is a strategy that has been highlighted from within China, or is this something that's been diagnosed from outside?
It's diagnosed from outside, but the terminology United Front, I think, is also used in China. It's just different researchers have a different framing of it. Some would call it FIMI, like foreign information manipulation and interference. Some would call it PRC malign influence. Some would call it United Front work.
Okay, this is a good way to frame it. Okay, so we've got a United Front project that's underway. And what does that mean, though, in practice, I guess, for someone who's whether they're in New Zealand and Japan, whether they're outside of China, what does that mean for their lived experience? What are the signs of the United Front?
It does evolve over time, but I can tell you perhaps a little bit about the research that has been done on this in the past year or two, where when it's a United Front, it's not just about the papers or the embassies issuing statements to try to refute what they see as misinformation or disinformation, which we do see these days in Japan, where they would perhaps be more combative with those statements. But if we're looking into the disinformation space, the FIMI space on social media, you will see, for example, a lot of short videos, reels from influencers, or a lot of them would be micro-influencers. They may not be the big names, but they would have the same talking points. They would have the same hashtags, same keywords, perhaps even the same framing. And they would all come out within the same few hours. You will see a surge in certain keywords and topics at a certain given hours. And if it is textual, like if they are just putting out tweets, for example, with fake accounts, you will see surges of it during the working hours in Beijing, because that's where a lot of their staff is based. But of course, this evolves with the evolution of AI. So it will change. Like, these patterns right now are based on people, like real people, alive people who are doing the work. But with AI, they can basically schedule and do this at much bigger magnitude, at a much more undetectable kind of mode, really.
And kind of breaking down the active mechanism within this, I think it would be easy to say, well, in some situations, maybe things seem united and that there is a clear message that's being pushed. But are there other goals here around, I say goals, but what is the desired outcome? Because in some cases, it seems as if the desired outcome is to confuse, not necessarily to push any particular narrative, but to have several narratives that all compete within someone's critical space to actually basically say, hey, I don't know what's going on. Mm. How would you sort of start to break down maybe some of those desired outcomes of the United Front?
I mean, you're absolutely right, Cody, because that's something that we noticed that has changed since last year. Because in 2024, say, for example, when we were in Taiwan, there was a big election last year. There is an obvious goal where they want people to vote a certain way or to doubt establishments. Whereas in 2025, we see a switch of that, where they may not be pushing you towards a very particular action or political behavior, but they would try to divide society. So instead of just putting out a brand new message or putting out outright disinformation that is easily proven factually incorrect, they start to exploit what is already contested in society. So there are topics, depending on the society, for example, same-sex marriage or death penalties or
trigger topics.
Yeah, like national, yeah, exactly. National security trigger topics.
That's interesting. I've got this theorist who I often reference, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work, a French theorist, mm-hmm. Jacques Ellul. He wrote about propaganda in France in the 1960s, mm-hmm. and you referenced the student riots, mm-hmm. and there was the Algerian War.
Yes.
And he talks about these kind of two forms that propaganda takes, and one is sort of, how would you say, clearing the field or sort of laying out of sort of a field of possible opinions to then later seed certain specific things. And there's sort of these two modes, ultimately both lead towards some kind of action required, but you have to maintain the volume mm-hmm. constantly. Sometimes you turn it down a little bit or you turn it up, but there's always a background volume, a background noise of propaganda taking place. And so effectively we can call perhaps United Front a propaganda effort, or...
I mean, it's definitely propaganda, but then at the same time, all governments engage in propaganda, right? So where is the line? That is something that we're looking into as well.
Yeah.
What is ethical and what isn't? Every country has its own national narrative. When does it become a problem that has to be dealt with internationally? When is the point of trigger where it's no longer abiding by international covenants or human rights standards that we all should be abiding by?
Well, one interesting thing as well, referencing again Jacques Ellul's work, and I mean this is pre-internet, but he seemed to think that there was a marked distinction between propaganda which is for your people and for your country, and then propaganda which doesn't really work in the same way externally. And so breaking down this United Front concept further, do you think there's a separate project for Chinese people? Is the United Front encapsulate targeting the messaging towards Chinese, or is this purely for external parties?
United Front work is mainly targeting external parties, but they would engage, for example, their diaspora in some of the work. Of course, not saying that all Chinese people in diaspora would be engaging in that work, but there are people who publish propaganda newspapers for the PRC while being abroad, or shops that are friendlier to the cause who would be doing that, or students who are asked to be spying on their fellow classmates. There are people and parties in diaspora who are involved in this, but it does often easily lead to pieces that say, oh, we shouldn't let in Chinese people because they are a danger to national security. And that's something that in the field of studying United Front work, we're trying to be more nuanced and careful about not perpetrating that sort of bias.
Well, you've written about this as well, that there can be some challenges here where the narrative, and I think you were writing in reference to ISIS, it eventually ends up painting all Muslims as potential a relation to ISIS kind of conceptually or in the public consciousness, whereas and in a sense that project from ISIS has succeeded in its own propaganda goal to militarize Muslim people globally. And are you suggesting perhaps there's a similar effect here where by banning Chinese students, for example, that they end up achieving a goal that is desired by the Chinese communists, or is it?
I think that by demonizing Chinese nationals or students who are abroad, it makes it easier for the Beijing government to say, oh, look at them, they're bullying us, so we should
band together
and fight against being bullied, we should stand up for ourselves, etc. It does contribute to that narrative.
Yeah, it's kind of like, classic example that people use is something like the Mormon Church, which sends its missionaries out in groups of two and are going to go door knocking, and they're generally going to get rejected. And that rejection actually reinforces the identity that person has as part of that organization. And it's sort of, in a sense, it's not about evangelizing in that situation. Mm-hmm. It's actually to sort of self-evangelize and self-harden beliefs, because you're now a victim of external pressure, right? Mm-hmm. And so potentially, as you say, these situations with university campuses, and here we are at the University of Tokyo even, it can create maybe an us versus them narrative.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you spoke about my research earlier on ISIS. So I did that on the psychopolitics of ISIS in Europe, because as opposed to the 9/11 attack in the US, where the terrorists came from abroad, in Europe, a lot of them were born and raised in Europe. However, they voluntarily chose to go to Syria to get trained and then go back to their home countries and carry out the attacks. So why was this? So one of this, the elements is that this us versus them kind of mentality, where perhaps their religious beliefs or their identities have not been respected in their perspective by these countries that they were born and raised in, despite being a national. So this created, as you mentioned, the victimhood mentality that, okay, they are trying to silence us, they're trying to not allow us to exist. And in turn, it becomes a fighting against the Goliath kind of situation that renders that narrative more self-justified. Like, we are David with the beliefs that we have, we are born how we are, but they are not respecting this and therefore hypocritical. So that's how it could evolve with the narrative with the PRC. Of course, not saying that they will eventually become terrorists, but it is a me versus them, and therefore we need to protect our own kind of narrative.
I think there's something psychological about it as well. When you have seen footage of Chinese students who are tearing down some Lenin wall, or they're abusing somebody in some situation where maybe someone has said something against China, and you can kind of just see in the way, in a lot of those engagements, they have this kind of look in their eye that it's kind of like a rage.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that it's almost been programmed, it's been pushed into them. It's not, I think, it's not a self-developed kind of critical response. It's almost like a knee-jerk response.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is really interesting because it's sort of conditioning, in a sense, that that person has been, a certain message has been sent out, or certain conditions have been met to make that person rage.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone's in that state, they're not going to be thinking clearly, right? They're going to be just sort of in very basic images, very basic terms they're going to be operating on, and even in violent terms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe kind of easier to manipulate, right, when someone's in that state of mind.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, be it on the PRC side or any social movement, rage and I think grief are very important motivators. And that often means that the messaging doesn't need to be very profound. Because if it's too
complicated, it needs to be simple, right?
Yeah.
It must be simple to be able to be picked up.
Yeah. Like, it needs to be fast, it needs to be clear, that something that can be repeated very easily by any citizen walking down the street, so that they can identify with that.
Yeah, and this is, again, the kind of, coming back to this kind of the theory of propaganda, the simplicity of the image. It's sort of a little bit like, I don't know if you've ever seen Inception.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, like, what is the simplest form of the idea?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some kind of nuanced relation with a foreign power, says kind of political stuff, it ultimately gets boiled down to maybe a feeling of unfairness, a feeling of grief or rage,
mm-hmm.
and associated with a very simple symbol, something like a certain individual or a color or a flag or something. And these images then kind of sprawl out, and people kind of get caught up in this, they get enchanted by this movement, you get mass formation, people join in, and you have a demonstration, right?
Yeah, and there are certain points that are, as you mentioned, are consistently mentioned or kind of put into the public consciousness of how perhaps the Chinese public sees themselves. For example, when they talk about Japan, obviously with the worsening of relations lately, there has been more demonizing. But even before this, because this year is the anniversary of the end of the Second World War, that they will start reaching out to countries like the Philippines, saying, oh, we are celebrating an anniversary of our bilateral relations. Remember back then, the Japanese were invading us, and we worked together to fight against this sort of evil power, et cetera. So that's something that they're perpetrating. Constantly, it's a me versus them. We were bullied, so we stood together, and we made it happen, and we won kind of situation. And that's something that, in spirit, has been peppered in here and there during different political events or current affairs.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's classic diplomacy, right? Using historical events and referencing them in kind of an abstract way, And I mean, we see this even with liberal democracies, places like South Korea, still referencing imagery that is historical and it kind of is used as a device.
Mm-hmm.
Even New Zealand, you know, everywhere that there's a political sphere, there is this use of images and stories.
Mm.
In fact, perhaps you could say it's a human thing. But this kind of approach that the PRC is taking with this United Front is very interesting, though, because it's being used to achieve outcomes, and these have real hegemonic effects, right? So the idea of China and the idea of freedom, for example, what is China, what is the Communist Party doing, these kinds of questions, I find when I'm talking to people about this, a lot of the propaganda has actually set in,
mm-hmm.
even with people outside of China.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you some examples of this. You know, obviously I've done a lot of episodes interviewing people about China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first thing that strikes me is all of the comments I get whenever I do a China episode that are calling me a CIA agent or whatever.
Oh, we all have that. They all say that we're getting paid by the CIA to protest. Imagine 2 million people being paid to protest by the CIA.
I mean, I have this little podcast, and I mean, I'm getting these comments, and it doesn't happen on any other episode, but it's like, yeah, whenever I do a China episode, I'm getting called out by what you would call a 50 cent army, right?
Oh, yeah.
And these are the people, as you say, that are working away and putting these comments, and in a way that some of them don't even really make sense, but what they do is they create like a confusion and they disrupt disrupt the truth sensing mechanisms that we might have otherwise, where we look at things critically and we sort of try to assess something based on certain values and criteria. But when you've got these kind of little messages and these kind of keywords that are being programmed into the comment section, or they're being broadcast on YouTube or TikTok in these like short reels and things, there's sort of like a neuro-linguistic programming, if you're familiar, like...
Yeah, of course.
These keywords, you know? And I don't know, what do you make of all of that?
I mean, they have always been around. It's not something new with the five cents and just trying to perpetrate certain propaganda messaging or just personally attacking you. A lot of it can be gender-based. We've seen a lot of that on X, on Facebook. A little less on Instagram, I guess. We don't use TikTok, so I have no idea.
We as in?
As in Hong Kongers don't use TikTok. Yeah. It's just a security concern, so we don't use TikTok or Douyin or any of that. But yeah, it is a little unsettling, especially when they dox people and they put a lot of personal attacks or a lot of personal information. Of course, you can always report them to the platform, but when it's in the hundreds, how many can you really report, you know?
Yeah, well, it's just, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is it's kind of like a meta question. Like we're kind of in this room trying to feel out some kind of meta structure that's outside of here.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, you know, it is easy to kind of get a little bit confused, right? Like what is even going on? And it's uncomfortable.
It is. And the thing is, the Chinese are very good at using the softer side of things to push this sentiment of familiarity, or that, for example, China has a very long history and beautiful literature and art pieces, cinema, etc. And a lot of this has been perpetrated and has shaped how some Sinologists, see China and how sympathetic they are to Beijing, particularly those who were in school in the 60s when the student movements were happening. There is this ideal version of what China can be, what the potential of Beijing and the communist idea. So there is that part where it doesn't seem so directly political, even that maybe somebody loves, for example, Hong Kong because of Jackie Chan, even though Jackie Chan is supportive of the Beijing regime and the prosecution and persecution of student leaders and movements. But because they know the films, they have the sense of familiarity, or maybe they've been on a language exchange program in Beijing or Shanghai. That's where a lot of that sympathy comes from.
If you want to go down a rabbit hole, so I recently watched, what's that Jackie Chan movie, Rush Hour?
Yeah.
Rush Hour. And I rewatched it recently for some reason, and It's incredible because that came out basically at the handover, basically like 97, 98, around that. Yeah. And absolutely it is a piece of communist propaganda.
Yeah.
It's got the characters, you know, they got the signing of the handover at the beginning of the film. Mm. We've got this evil white guy who's he's like stolen all this art treasure. Mm. And you've got these Hong Kong police going to the US and going extra legal and getting involved. Like, there's all of this stuff layered into it. And I was like, wow, it reminds me a little bit. There's an older film that came out just after World War II called Tokyo Joe. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen that?
I know of it, but I've never seen
it. It's got Humphrey Bogart. And again, clearly this is a piece. It's kind of quaint now for us to look back because it's like basically trying to brush away 4 years of the Pacific War with Humphrey Bogart and, you know, these kind of icons of Hollywood in like 1946, basically because immediately they needed the Japanese to be on side and the Americans to be on side with the Japanese going into the Korean War and to fight the Soviets. And it was like, yeah, the use of Hollywood and film for that. Again, I mean, it's a whole rabbit hole, but
there's a book on this. That's a very good book on this. I think it came out in 2021. Okay. Might be worth looking into it. The Chinese influence in Hollywood, basically, because so many films, the money that finances these films, a lot of it should be from China. Maybe not directly, some of it maybe indirectly, but they do result in films like that being produced. You also have actors being forced to apologize if they happen to say that Taiwan is a country, things like that.
Yeah,
you know, but also. Going back to your point about neurolinguistics, the fact that the term handover is what is being used so majorly instead of transfer of sovereignty is in itself, is it a propaganda? But it is a framing of the PRC, of the whole situation where they asked the UN to take Hong Kong out of a list of colonies, resulting in Hong Kong people not having the right to vote for their own future, as opposed to other colonies. To this point where the official narrative of Beijing is that Hong Kong has never been a colony of the British.
It was handed over, yeah.
Because handover insinuates that it should have been returned. But now, at this point, they don't even talk about it anymore because in their eyes, Hong Kong was never a colony.
That's fascinating. As you say that sort of the policing of language, because again, this is something Chris Horton mentioned in his book when I interviewed him. Even the word mainland, what does that mean? I mean, part of Hong Kong is on the mainland itself in the new territories. It's the island is the island, but where did these languages of mainland of Hong Kong, of Taiwan, like, what is the interplay and how do we subconsciously just use those words now? And in fact, we're sort of supporting a propaganda project. Yeah.
Exactly, because when you say mainland China, well, in Mandarin would be Neidi, Cantonese would be Noidi. It means that you are part of that. So if a Taiwanese person says mainland China, they mean that they agree that Taiwan would be part of this structure. And relative to Taiwan, that part of China would be the mainland, right? But even with Hong Kong, we always said when I was living there, we call that part mainland China. But these days they're trying to reframe it again as Chinese mainland, basically perpetrating the idea that Hong Kong is part of the bigger collective, and therefore relative to Hong Kong, that is a mainland.
Yeah, well, this is interesting as well, because this gets into this idea of oneness, which Frank Dakota has spoken about quite a bit and written about. But fundamentally, I mean, his arguments are that it's not like China is doing something different. Fundamentally, they are communists. They are Chinese communists. And the fundamental of that is there's unity required, a singleness. And so all of China, I understand, is on a single time zone, single language, Han Chinese kind of identity, an assimilation of non-Han Chinese into that.
Yeah.
And then thus, of course, China, there can't be any islands that are outside of that. They all have to be part of China.
Yeah.
And this kind of reflects a communist, fundamentally a communist ideology, right?
The thing is, the Communist Party of China is only communist when it's convenient for them, and not so communist when it's less convenient for them. So if anything, how they run their businesses, it is very capitalist, especially 10 to 20 years ago, after it first opened, it's extremely capitalist. But when it's inconvenient to be capitalist, they start reining it in and inserting more state power. And that state power sometimes is not justifiable. It also does not achieve the goal of redistributing resources so that the collective can equally have access to those resources. So it's only convenient, they only use it when it's convenient for them. For example, this whole oneness collective thing.
Well, that said though, I mean, the idea of historical materialism is that you would pass through a capitalist phase, and it's sort of, my understanding, again, of referencing Frank Dakota's work, was that, the overarching architecture is that it is communist in that it will use little bits of capitalism through the process towards eventually the utopia, to get to the utopia of communism, which, again, it doesn't seem kind of relevant maybe in everyday conversations. Oh, it's not as if Xi Jinping has a utopian vision for the Chinese people, whereas fundamentally it seems as if he does have that vision, and everything that gets in the way of that must necessarily be destroyed. And this is the problem with utopian thinking, is that any cost, any amount of deaths can be justified if it means we achieve utopia. And I think this is a marked contrast to kind of the practical realities of liberal democracies, where it's like, there is some red lines we don't cross when it comes to human rights. But I don't know what your thought is on that, whether you've looked into some of the writing of Xi Jinping, and whether you see a communist ideology within that, within his thought.
I mean, there is of course elements of communism, because that's the party official ideologies. It's just, I don't think he is necessarily always motivated by the communist ideology.
Okay.
I think a huge part of the decision-making process for him is his legacy, really, his personal legacy instead of the party legacy. How does he put himself in the same ranks as Mao and Deng? Because you have somebody who has started the Cultural Revolution, who basically founded the PRC, somebody who modernized the PRC economically to allow for it to become a modern country, really. But if it comes to Xi, since he's staying in power until basically the end of his life, what does he have to perpetuate him to that kind of stratosphere? And I think it's not just about the ideology, because I would argue that all leaders of the PRC have tried to adhere more or less to bits and pieces, if not more of it, of the communist ideology. Is just what makes Xi different is that, first of all, yes, you mentioned the lesser regard of human life or human cost to achieving what he's trying to achieve, but I think also is because his decision-making is very much on resolving the Hong Kong problem, and now it is the Taiwan problem that he has to resolve to allow for his legacy to be seen as a leader that has changed fundamentally the PRC.
So there's kind of ultimately a deep-seated ego problem here.
I think so, certainly, because a lot of it doesn't seem very logical or make sense economically or in terms of human cost.
Well, it's interesting though, because again, the other perhaps brain worm or brain mind virus that exists is that somehow, and I see this amongst my own friends, in particular American friends, that somehow China is this super advanced place where they're building rail tunnels and high-speed railways and skyscrapers and all of these things, while in particular with the United States, you know, you can't get anything done, there's all these barriers, and in particular with the Trump regime, it's maybe easy to contrast those and say, oh, if only we had central planning and five-year plans and communism, we could do this too. And I find that quite problematic, and I'm always quick to remind people that somewhere like New Zealand or Australia is still very functional, and democracy works and civil society works, and it's just kind of the United States is at a weak moment right now. But I'm always caught when people are like, man, those Chinese know how to get things done, right? And I mean, what's your take on that as maybe it's kind of like techno-nationalism, the kind of the propaganda of techno-nationalism?
I mean, of course, when the government or the leader has centralized power, things are more efficient, right? Because there's no obstacle. He or she or they do whatever they want. If anything, I think a better example of that is probably Singapore, where I feel like it has more equal distribution of resources, where people have a much higher quality of life compared to China right now. The economy is so bad that most fresh graduates from university would not be able to find any sort of job. They'd just be underemployed or unemployed in China. And people are not living all that well. So I think a better example of that, the centralized power leading to efficient governance, would be Singapore. However, if you are completely immune or if you silence civil society completely and therefore not accept any sort of criticism, things will start to go awry eventually, because one person cannot be the owner of all knowledge on all situations. So you will make a misstep eventually if you would fire anybody who would tell you something that is not to your liking.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, just coming back to some of these narratives, which I think are, it's worth pause for thought whenever we encounter these, but certainly the easy one that everyone references is that China brought 500 million people out of poverty is always talked about. And I have people say this to me all the time. And it's like, well, did the Chinese government do that, or did the Chinese people do that? And it's two different things. Mm. And in a sense, it's almost like what Frank Dakota would say is that it was the case that the Chinese government finally let them get themselves out of poverty with the reforms of the 1980s. Mm. And that's like quite a distinct difference, right? It's almost like the communists are trying to take credit for this great humanitarian project, which they actually caused problem in the first place.
I mean, that's consistent with the fire narrative of anything. You have these people who are everyday citizens just trying to do their part, donating not only money, but also like blankets, clothes, etc., to the families and individuals affected by the fire in Taipei. But then you have these government-ordained volunteers, so to say, taking photos in front of it, taking the credit, saying, oh, hey, look how much we're helping the victims of the fire, but it's not actually them. But you do have that pattern of taking credit for things like that, for humanitarian relief, etc.
What I wanted to get to as well, which is another thing that I often, a discussion-ending statement or an argument-ending statement that often comes up is that, isn't this kind of thing coming out of the United States as well, though, when it comes to propaganda shaping and narrative shaping? They're just as bad as each other. There's no kind of gradation of government in a sense. I mean, how would you frame, and particularly the United States, is there an equivalent to what we see with the United Front? Is there something like that going on? How would you compare and contrast?
I mean, I think it circles back to what I mentioned earlier, where each country has their national narrative and their version of propaganda. But with the United States, you see people fighting against it vocally, not only abroad, but also on the ground, that they're not okay with this. This is not the government or sort of governance that they are okay with. And eventually, they should be able to change their leaders if they're not happy with the current situation through democratic means, through voting and through protest. Well, with the Chinese, it's just no longer possible. If you're very vocal in protests in the street saying that, the government did a very bad job with COVID, leading to economic disarray in China, and therefore leaving a lot of Chinese displaced or unemployed, etc., you would probably get in trouble. Your families would probably be phoned if they're in China, being told by the national police, please tell your son or daughter to stop doing or messing up or causing trouble abroad. We have had that during the White Paper movement in 2023 of Chinese students abroad who have been more vocal against the government because quality of life was so bad in China during and post-COVID, and their family members being harassed or asked the student to stop, basically. But you don't really have that with the US, despite perhaps things not going smoothly and basically the government perhaps not adhering to certain, allegedly not adhering to certain parts of the Constitution and not being held accountable for it. But there are people who are on the ground who are still able to say this, and they're not experiencing mass political arrests, you know.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so there's sort of the chilling effect that exists within China, and in particular the pernicious use of family connections. Mm. The classic example was inviting the family back in China to have tea at the police station, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's the one that's always referenced. And even in Hong Kong, I believe.
These days, yes, basically.
I believe even Carmen Lau, our mutual acquaintance and mutual friend, her family members were invited to have tea at the police station to talk about things. Obviously, she's in exile in the UK. And so we've got this use of the family device, which is, again, court of Chinese society and is being sort of exploited in this very dark way.
Yeah.
Right.
The thing is, when you are engaged in politics or in social movements, you know what you're in for, yeah? Like, you know that by speaking up that there are risks and that you will face censorship and you might have to be in exile or imprisoned, etc. But that is on you because you did the action, you will suffer the consequence. But when they extend it to your friends and your family members, if anything, it might be even harder if they are harassing the family members that you're not even that close with, because they are not involved in this or in the know at all. And somehow they're implicated.
Well, it's deeply unfair. Yeah. And there's like a, yeah, there's something pernicious about that, which could make someone cease doing what they're doing. Right?
Yeah, it's very hostile and very malicious.
And so this is interesting. So we're kind of starting to sketch a picture here, this idea of the United Front, which is perhaps a useful tool, even just for people listening to this, maybe it's as a way of framing it. And, you know, you don't want to get too simplistic, but being able to point at something and to give it a label at least helps you start to categorize it. And this is maybe quite easy to see. There's actually this New Zealand guy who's maybe the same sort of age as me, who's based in Shanghai, and I won't mention his name, but he is like basically a mouthpiece for the Chinese communists. And he's got this super successful YouTube channel, really big, blah, blah, blah. And I don't fully understand what's on the backside, you know, how he's getting paid for this. But it's interesting because he's basically saying he talks to every propaganda point of the Communist Party, whether it's Xinjiang or Taiwan or whatever. He's got a video on it, and it's done in this kind of very YouTube influencer kind of a way. And I mean, I think we can point to that and say, okay, here we go, United Front. And maybe we don't know the exact details of how he's getting paid or who his handlers are, but there's kind of now we have a label for it. And it's not like, oh, he just happens to be there doing it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because you have these huge budgets for national security, both in Hong Kong and in China. So that's where the money's coming from, at least officially. And it does help to have a name just so that we can centralize the ideas or the testimonies or the collection of events that where this is happening.
Well, and it's interesting because, again, if you look up Xinjiang, you know, and I've done episodes talking about this, I mean, there is a reality on the ground and there's been deep research on that. But then there's people walking around with selfie sticks saying, hey, do you see any genocide here?
Yeah, exactly.
And
flew people there, right?
Fly people there and they do these tours. And in some cases, they're kind of wrapped in this banality of like kind of travel vlog kind of stuff. Like they've started to use the medium with a degree of sophistication, right?
Yeah, because I think it was last year, I think, they flew out bunches of influencers in fashion and beauty and basically showed them factories in Xinjiang saying, do you see any forced labor? Like, this is a very beautiful piece of clothing, maybe sold on Shein. Would you still buy this? This is very fashionable. And, you know, look at the conditions of our workers in the factory, etc. And they would film it and kind of put out this image to their audience, which may not be their conventional audience for direct Chinese propaganda. And that's how they get to it. And speaking of Xinjiang, they have also, you may have seen recent reports about a British academic basically being silenced by a university in the UK on her and her team's research surrounding forced labor in Xinjiang. Basically, they asked her to stop the research and stop the center that she was a director of, which does this sort of research.
It's worth pointing out as well for people who don't know, almost every university in, certainly New Zealand, but globally, has a Confucius Institute attached to it.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe you could explain what that is as kind of,
I mean, Confucius Institutes have been a pretty focal point of studying United Front in the past 5 to 10 years. Almost every university, for example, in the UK or the US or even Australia, they would have one. Basically, it adheres to what I mentioned a little earlier, which is the softer side of Chinese identity, or China's identity rather, through language learning, through cultural events, etc. But they have also been found to have participated in more political missions, for example, spying on people, information gathering, and giving that information to consulates or embassies of the PRC on the ground there. And more maliciously, some of them would be doing the harassment, but mainly I would say their role is to foster a more positive sentiment or feeling or perspective towards the PRC and doing a lot of the information gathering.
Well, it's also the kind of the role of de facto what symbols are in our media landscape. What are people seeing? What are 18-year-old students seeing when they're in university for the first time? They're seeing Chinese Communist flags and the Confucius Institute, which again, in Wellington, New Zealand, you know, where I went to university, we have a Confucius Institute and you know, the students, local students and exchange students coming over, foreign students coming over, they're going to be seeing these kind of symbols, right?
Yeah.
And this begins to play into some of these narrative shapings that take place.
Yeah.
And so whether it's something like Chinese film festivals, which of course I'm never going to have a Taiwanese film, or anything in a non-Mandarin language, some dialect of China, or you know, sports events or anything, you know, you've kind of got this watchful eye.
Exactly.
Sort of always hovering, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've probably heard that in New York, there was recently supposedly to a individual, a more indie kind of China film festival happening, but of course that was shut down. So only certain Chinese films can be shown according to the government.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Just kind of to wrap up this piece on the propaganda, though. I mean, again, I have these conversations with people about, you know, that China's building high speed rail and railways and skyscrapers. That's kind of the high, but we miss the low of substandard quality, scandals, all sorts of things, and then obviously the vast amounts of rural China that never see that, because we're talking about a number of coastal cities that have maybe a couple of the inland cities as well, but mostly the Chinese people in these non major cities are living in squalor in a lot of cases, and so you get one picture painted, you don't get to see the other side but the effect of that is that someone's like, oh well, look, you know, we can't even New Zealand, we can't build a road. And there starts to be this maybe the sympathy for what can be done and what can be achieved when you have a single party state.
Yeah.
And a bit of sympathy that the Chinese were able to do this, they were able to bring their people out of poverty, et cetera, et cetera. And so you start having these narratives get kind of formed inception style, right?
The thing is, it's very selective, right? Like if you go to North Korea and you follow their propaganda path as a tourist there, you would say, oh, I mean, North Korea is a very advanced country. They have their own, you know, space projects, et cetera. You would say that. But that's obviously not reflective of what the majority of North Koreans have been experiencing. The same with China. You have Shanghai, you have Beijing, all these great buildings, huge avenues. Of course, you have the R&D companies that really look into very innovative bits of science and development of tech. But the majority of Chinese is not benefiting from this. Back in during the era of Deng, I believe, there's this propaganda slogan that says "先让一部分人富富起来," just it means that we will let a part of the country become rich first, and then the rest will become rich with them.
Yeah.
Which obviously it seems that after like a century that we're still stuck in this phase of development, but of course, as you mentioned, that is being covered by the more positive sides of development in certain cities in China.
Yeah. So I guess the final piece on kind of the propaganda, and then I am keen to talk about infrastructure here, is at a high level for you, I mean, how do we practice information hygiene? How do we inoculate ourselves against some of these effects of the United Front? How do we check our own biases, and how do we look at these things with clear eyes? What are some approaches or things that you've been able to glean over the years to help you understand this vast information landscape?
I think, first of all, we used to rely quite a lot on the big tech companies, the social media platforms, to help do the fact-checking. But given the changes in governance and how they decide to allocate their resources, they have a minimized, if not non-existent, fact-checking team these days. So there are, depending on where you are based in, different civil society organizations that still do the fact-checking, but they are not part of the platform, and therefore it doesn't automatically just pop up. So I say that if there's any news that seems a little fishy, or if it's major news and a lot of news push has been put out, it's worth going through the keywords and looking into these fact-checking organizations and see if they've put out a piece on it. Because with the algorithm, they're not going to automatically show up on your feed or your timeline. You probably have to look for it. And of course, the importance of media literacy and that being part of the curriculum in, if not all countries, at least the liberal democratic countries, where we understand the difference between reality, truth, or propaganda, or certain perspectives, and what truth actually means, right? Because truth can be subjective, but reality or facts cannot be. It is what it is. So how do you identify that? It should be part of the curriculum. And thirdly, I'd say don't react immediately. You mentioned my piece for NK Asia. The fire started on the 26th of November, and my piece came out, I think, the 1st of December. Yeah, like I think really take your time to let the information settle down first, because if things seem fishy, like the whole propaganda around bamboo, then it will probably have encountered some sort of resistance, either online or in person or from certain political figures, etc., within the next 24 to 46 hours, after which you will probably see some sort of fact-checking from media. If it's not the local media, you will see it from an international media.
So there's perhaps these lagging indicators, because obviously it takes a lot of work to fact-check and
exactly.
Do real work.
Yeah.
And so maybe take a deep breath, slow down. Don't react to things straight away. And I must admit, you know, I was, there was one incident recently, there was Maki Otsuki's One Piece performance, the famous anime, she's an anime singer, her performance got cancelled halfway through.
Yeah.
And she got pulled off stage. Mm-hmm. You would have seen
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And I must admit, I mean, I reacted to that, you know, I thought, fuck, you know, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
And I needed to sort of take a deep breath, because it would have been easy to go and like say something about that and kind of, you know, react to it in the moment. But I think it, in a way, if we actually look at that moment, I'd be keen to hear what you think. But my feeling was that it was perfectly architected to create that kind of reaction in someone like me, who was like, they could have just done it before the show. They didn't have to wait until 40 minutes in or whatever to pull her off stage. But they did that to achieve the maximum impact, which was to upset people.
Yes.
And I mean, would you say that sort of that was the outcome that they were trying to achieve, to upset people, to make it seem as if they were putting on this petty incident they were trying to... Yeah.
Not necessarily petty. I'd say that on the Chinese side, it shows that they mean business.
Okay.
Even if it means pulling you off a stage mid-show, first of all. Second of all, with the hyper-realism in AI, It is worth taking a breath and making sure the video is real, which I think in this case it was real. But the thing is, by sharing that piece of information, what are the people who are benefiting from it? And for example, if you share it from a lens that look at the Chinese being unreasonable, then of course you have to start thinking about who's benefiting from it. And if you're angling from, oh, look at the Chinese, they mean business, they're not going to take this kind of bullying from Japan or the US, then it's benefiting another set of stakeholders.
The other thing is, on that particular note, it also gives this kind of omnipotence to the Chinese communists, which I think we have to be very critical of, because, you know, was there some cadre who was like, okay, on this day in Shanghai, there's going to be this performance from this Japanese singer, we're going to pull her off stage and we're going to architect this whole thing, and it would give the illusion that they have an all-seeing eye.
Mm.
And that makes you then want to self-censor and be a little bit careful, because, you know, are they watching us right now? When, in fact, perhaps there's no one behind the curtain.
Mm.
And this was one example that was used to kind of give that impression.
Mm.
And that maybe that's a way of looking at it. And in that case, it maybe succeeded in a degree. It's like, yeah, these guys knew how to execute, and they mean business, as you say.
Yeah, because there is an all-seeing eye, because all shows, especially from foreign artists, they have to be submitted for approval from the Chinese government. They have to submit their entire song list, have all the lyrics translated to Chinese so they can actually approve or not approve.
Well, you would have worked in this space a little bit.
I know people who work in the space. I've never been to a show in China, north of Hong Kong at least. So I haven't been in the industry, but I know people who have been in the industry who have helped artists, say from Japan, do shows in China, and they have to go through that process. Okay. It's just part of the process of approval.
Okay, so when you were a fixer in Hong Kong back in the day, that wasn't like that.
In Hong Kong, no. The point of whether that is approved or not is certainly not based on what songs you're singing.
Yeah.
It's basically just whether they have that availability at that given venue and whether you can pay the money.
So moving on, something we mentioned at the beginning, submarine cables as a physical manifestation of control of the media. This is an interesting idea. You wrote for the Jamestown Foundation this article, the PRC seeks dominance in submarine power cable infrastructure.
Yes.
And perhaps, does this also extend to communication cables?
Yes, it's just because at the time communications cables have been talked about quite a bit. It's just offering a new angle to this and also including power cables.
So tell me a bit about this, because again, we've got this narrative here, Chinese industry dominating these certain key global industries. There's like a Chinese company that will come in and dominate.
Mm-hmm.
What is your high level thesis on this, in particular with these submarine cables, but infrastructure generally? Mm. What does it all mean with the Chinese?
Mm. I think first of all they planned this pretty early on, and we see this manifesting in the negotiations with the US and their ban on rare earth exports, because they already take up so much of the processing of such materials that it is just unthinkable at this point to have the rest of the world all decouple from the PRC. It's just impossible. So that becomes a bargaining chip for them. And that is not something that just happened over the past 2 to 3 years. It's something that has been at least a decade, if not more, in the making. And you can look to Made in China 2025, the whole plan and their strategy towards implementing themselves as a key stakeholder in the world supply chain of certain industries, with telecommunications, etc., being part of that. Of course, green energy being a huge part of that plan as well, which is why it is so difficult to de-risk completely from the PRC if you're trying to achieve the goals of a green energy transition, because they're still holding so much of, if not the material itself, but then the processing capabilities. And with that, it means that they can hold these capabilities hostage in any sort of international negotiations. So if they're negotiating with Australia and perhaps they could threaten a ban on exporting certain critical minerals or rare earth, et cetera, that is necessary for even the everyday iPhone. Semiconductor capabilities, they're certainly catching up with Taiwan, not only on legacy chips, but also the more advanced versions. And that could mean that, first of all, they won't have to rely on the rest of the world, which means they don't have to care about what the rest of the world has to say. But if there are countries which are still reliant on Chinese chips, which could be cheaper, then they would be affected in negotiations.
That's interesting. You're right here. Reliance on strategic rivals for critical infrastructure opens recipient states to vulnerabilities that those rivals can exploit. Previous examples include Germany's reliance on energy supplied by Russia's Nord Stream pipeline and various countries' reliance on Huawei to provide critical telecommunications infrastructure.
Yes.
I mean, this was even in little old New Zealand, this was a talking point with Huawei and 5G rollout. And again, this sort of dominance of Chinese manufacturing means we're in this difficult situation, right? Where it is quite hard to decouple from that, right?
It is. And it's not even just from the economic security side. If we're talking telecommunications, especially with 5G, for example, it means that Chinese companies will have, to an extent, jurisdiction, if not just access, to that sort of data. And it's not just the individual data. It could be big data that could make Chinese have an upper hand on any sort of negotiation and any sort of perhaps attack in the event of a warfare or of a contingency. It means that they could know perhaps where a lot of that infrastructure is concentrated, and therefore they know where to attack, where to bomb, etc. That can be intelligence that we don't want a hostile state to have.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of metadata, especially on the telecommunications side, that will be coming off of. Oodles and oodles of data coming off these things, and that kind of phoning home and delivering that data back to perhaps an increasingly AI-capable nation like China, which can parse it and actually use it for some kind of analysis, it's kind of like a sword of Damocles hanging over any kind of country, and especially, again, these countries that I like to hold up and say, hey, this is an example of a thriving democracy, somewhere like New Zealand, where there can be a change of government without any bloodshed. It's those small countries exactly that are the most vulnerable to changes in trade or economic restrictions. You know, New Zealand, Australia, major trade partners would be somewhere like China.
Yeah, because we are in the same region, and of course it makes more sense to trade with people within the, well, countries within the region, because it's less shipping, it's more convenient. The needs are more similar, et cetera.
So zooming out though, again, I mean, we talked about the kind of narrative shaping before, but I think, I mean, there seems as if, I mean, there is like an omnipotence to this kind of planning or kind of approach towards strategic industries like these underwater cables. How do we frame this? How do we understand this? Because is it a case that there's naivety from these other countries that everything's going to be okay? Or is there actually a slow but gradual ratcheting up of the stakes to a point where maybe they don't have any chips left to bargain with? I mean, how would you sort of frame the situation and where it's going?
With submarine cables, it's an infrastructure that has been in place for the past 2 to 3 decades. It's not something that can be just easily changed and say, oh, we are rerouting all these cables. That's just not feasible. So we're basically stuck with the cables as they are. Of course, new cable systems are being installed as we speak, but a lot of it will pass through contested waters. And I think with the recent malicious sabotage of submarine cables in initially the Baltic Seas and eventually in the recent 2 to 3 years, increasingly in the Taiwan Strait. And that has, I think, got the world thinking a bit more about what this infrastructure means, how essential it is, especially for our region, given that we have that many island nations in the Asia Pacific, and how this can be a vulnerability and how do we de-risk. So it has become more of a focal point in economic security discussions or geoeconomics as of late for the past year or two about how, for example, not only the creation and laying of the cables, but the repair capacities as a region. How do we make sure that we're not reliant on China and therefore give the telecommunications data access to China if they are the only choice for repairing, for example.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at, I mean, the cables are one thing, right? But then there's obviously all of the other infrastructure that maybe has a heavy dependence on some, you know, being supplied by China. And how do we frame this? Because is it just a path of the course that we need to, you know, get affordably priced equipment? We need to have... you know, there's kind of economic considerations. But I guess, where is this all heading towards? I mean, is it more like we need to sort of ring the alarm a bit more and say, hey, well, really, there needs to be some strategic decisions at a national level to not use these suppliers? Or is there somewhere in the middle? Like, how do you frame all of that? Like,
I mean, I spoke about this a little bit for some of the Chinese language, Mandarin, and Cantonese interviews that I've done lately. I also wrote a little bit about this for Nikkei Asia last month, I think. The thing is, it needs to become a norm for democratic countries to understand that they have to pay a premium to secure their supply chains and their economy. It's no longer the case to just simply go for the cheapest option and to make sure that their companies or their citizens are earning the most money. Pure capitalism would not work in this instance. Of course, it's important to ring the alarm, but there needs to be more public-private partnerships, because for a lot of the infrastructure surrounding critical infrastructure is not necessarily profit-earning, and therefore private companies would not be incentivized to making those decisions or to have that redundancy just in case. So the governments will have to step in.
This is an interesting concept. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, if we go back to some, with New Zealand, for example, if we go back to the 1970s, 1960s, There were these external shocks that happened with, in particular in the 73 with the oil shock, leading immediately to a kind of knee-jerk reaction to actually suddenly build energy sovereignty, which led to this spate of hydro schemes and massive building of power stations in New Zealand, which was kind of not seen before or since. And that was only possible by the intervention of the state. And I am generally quite critical of the state and of public works. But in that situation, I mean, those are pieces of infrastructure that are still working for New Zealand. And so what you're suggesting potentially is that is a model we need to revisit of more engagement with the state in a at a national level to build our things which otherwise wouldn't be served in the free market or would be served by the Chinese, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, this would also, just sorry, be looking at, say, Africa, which generally a lot of these countries have underperforming bureaucracies, underperforming governments. Those are exactly the victims that are being targeted here, right? Who are, the Chinese are coming in and say, hey, don't worry about it, we'll work on
it. We'll pay for you and you will be indebted to us. Basically, the Belt Road Initiative, and eventually they have framed this as a global self-empowerment. And this right to development that they're trying to perpetuate in UN mechanisms, where by not allowing them to do this, they, the UN, in the PRC's eyes, which is benefiting Western countries, so to say, would be depriving these countries of their right to development. And they prioritize this over any other right that has been stipulated in international covenants under the UN system. And that's a reframing that they're trying to push for.
Interesting. Okay, so there's sort of perhaps a broader conversation. I mean, what would you like to see, or what do you think is important for democratic nations to be undertaking at this time in terms of asking these questions internally about the reliance on China, the premium for sovereign infrastructure that you talk about? I mean, how do you, what do you think, what was your recommendation there? What is your thoughts on that?
I believe the word for this is strategic autonomy. It's not feasible for a lot of these countries to completely decouple from China. And some of them still want that trade relationship or to try to be civil and diplomatic about it. And but there would be a bottom line. It's just to make sure that you have a choice when the bottom line is hit. So there needs to be investment from the government to securitize the critical infrastructure. Because as you summarized a little earlier, that they simply wouldn't happen under the free market. There needs to be government intervention. It's just, of course, with democratic countries, the state also needs to be held accountable. So yes, state intervention, but also accountability measures where the public can hold the government accountable for this, because these are huge projects. They would touch huge parts of the national budget, which of course citizens would be contributing to via tax or other means.
And longer term, Athena, looking at this situation we have in China, which is there is an economic downturn. There's there's pockets of obviously different situations, but generally it seems as if there's an economic downturn. But there's also a lot of chaos happening out of the US. Do you have I'm not necessarily asking for a prediction, but do you have a sort of a vision or an idea of, say, what we can look at for the next 24 months? What are you focusing on? What are the signs that you're looking for when it comes to what China is doing?
I mean, first of all, given that my regional focus is on East Asia, of course, Taiwan is top of the agenda. I also look for any changes of how they respond to things in Hong Kong. For example, how they responded to civil efforts around the Taipo fire this time is quite different from how they used the national security law a year ago or 2 years ago. And you see an evolution of how that governance or that perspective or part of the government responsible for national security for the PRC, how they see things, because how we understand it as a citizen and how Beijing in its governance would see things is not necessarily the same. They have a different set of logic. And first of all, that governance bit, but also the upcoming 15th five-year plan to see where the priorities are. They've already had a plenum to give recommendations to this upcoming plan, but it should be coming out in 2026, I believe. And you will see the next 5 years, what are their priorities and where they go from here. And it's very likely that it's going to be very focused on tech and maritime infrastructure and probably space infrastructure.
That's interesting. And then, of course, this weekend we have the Legislative Council elections.
Yes, that's correct.
In Hong Kong. So,
yeah.
Kind of interesting timing, right, where there's an election taking place, but perhaps we may see quite low turnout from the voters.
Yes, which for me seems not very logical because they spend so much money and time to try to boost voter turnout. And given the tragedy at hand, if they carry on with their vote on Sunday, which they have indicated that they would, that basically cancels all the efforts that they've put in and all the money, et cetera, that they've put in for the past month or two on this. And if anything, I think a lot of us don't understand why they even care, because it's not like it's a real choice.
Well, it seems like the only, I mean, the low turnouts, I think in the 30s, I think, some sort of between 30% and 40% turnout last time, but this time perhaps similar or lower. The idea is that that's the only option, is to just not vote now as your sign of kind of no confidence, right?
I mean, asking people to not vote or to vote blank is illegal in Hong Kong law, and they have wanted people over it, even people who are overseas.
Okay, so soliciting, pushing for people to not vote or to blank vote is
illegal.
Okay, interesting.
So you have people like, I mean, before Carmen was bounted, her initial charge was on this, because she asked people to not vote or to vote blank in the last election. Same with, for example, Ted Hui in Australia. He did the same thing, and he had a similar charge by, I think, the ICAC. So, there are people who have gotten in trouble, legal trouble, because of this.
Interesting. But that said, still, I mean, the people themselves choosing not to vote is an indication of a vote of no confidence for this, for what the regime, I guess, because what else are they going to do? The candidates have been handpicked by Beijing. Yeah.
So. The thing is, the result will still be the same. It's just how they frame this. If there's a higher voter turnout, they will say that this is people ordained. They represent the people. And look at them, they have competence in our governance, etc. But our guess is that they probably don't have a choice this time, because it seems that they just want to get it over with quickly.
Yeah.
If they do delay and really get into an investigation of the fire, who knows when it's actually going to happen with the elections. It's probably going to take a year or something.
Interesting. This is all incredibly fascinating, Athena. If people want to follow your work, your writing, where do you want to send them?
Either on LinkedIn or, my Meta social profiles are public on Instagram, athena.movement, or a little less active on Facebook, but I am on there. Increasingly using Twitter a bit more again, because I realize it's a different audience. That would be Athena Tong K, I believe, with my handle. Yeah.
So, Athena, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.